Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another edition of Midrats. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And glad you're with us here for this beautiful afternoon to talk with us about a returning subject that obviously has been on the top of everybody's attention span the last few months. But as you'll see during the course of the show, we're going to ignore most of that chatter, and we're really looking forward to focusing on Russia in perhaps a little more informative and instructive way. And for those that are with us live, we'd love to hear some feedback from you during the course of the show. So if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find a link to the chat room. You can come in there with the usual suspects. And if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, that's a great place to put it. Or if there's a question you would like for us to direct towards our guest, we'll be glad to grab that and fold that into the questions as the hour progresses. If you got a runoff some way, for some reason, halfway during the show, and you want to catch up on what you've missed, you can always come back and get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or save yourself the trouble and just subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes or Stitcher. And now diving back in to the topic of today, for the last 8 months or so, there's been a lot of talk in the 24-hour news cycle about Russia and the various things that are going on. But in the background, behind what we may have been hearing, there have been some very important developments, not just for the Russophiles around there, but those interested in European, Central Asian, and Middle Eastern security and American security that we're going to try to talk on today, from the Baltics all the way down to the Middle East, and the growing influence that Russia is having throughout the national security arena on the global stage. Our returning guest today to discuss this entire spectrum of things will be Dr. Dmitry Gornberg. He is a senior research scientist at CNA, a nonprofit think tank, and a writer that you can catch his latest and greatest over at the Russia Military Reform blog that you can find linked to on the show page. Dr. Gornberg conducts research on security issues in the former Soviet Union, Russia military reform, Russian foreign policy, ethnic politics and identity, and the Russian regional politics. He's also the editor of the Journal for the Problems in Post-Soviet Communism and a fellow at the Truman National Security Project. From 2005 to 2010, he was the executive director of the American Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies, and from 2009 to 2016, the editor of the Journal of Russian Politics and Law. Dmitry, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks for having me back.
And during the pre-show, for our listeners, we were talking about how I think in the past it's mostly been incidental, but we might have to make it a tradition now to have Dmitry on this time of the year, because we wanted to kick off the show to give for him an opportunity to share with us annually every year for the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 years or so, it may be, maybe even longer. There's been the Moscow Conference on International Security, and he just returned from the 2017 edition of that. And you can find out some of the issues that they ran into, not over at Dmitry's blog, but also with Michael Hoffman. They have penned a work at the National Interest on what they saw and some of the major issues, and we'll link to that over there in the chat room for the listeners to be able to catch. And just to kick things off, this has been a heck of a year for anybody who actually is or is interested in Russia military, national security, and diplomatic issues. And I'd be interested to hear your firsthand perspective Did you notice a change in atmosphere or focus of the topics at this year's conference compared to previous years?
Yeah, well, this is the fourth time I've attended. I think it's the it might be the sixth overall. So you're pretty much on right on there in terms of how long they've been doing this thing. I'm sort of beginning to get the sense that they've run out of ideas on the Russian side in terms of what to talk about at this conference. So the theme this year was global terrorism and the threat of the threat that poses to the world, which is the same theme they had last year, and that sort of it was interesting to get the different perspectives, but it did seem like it had become a little bit, there's a formula now, and they're kind of, as opposed to, say, the first year or two that I went, where they were still, I think, trying out how best to organize the format and who to invite and what tone to take. Now it's kind of, they know, everything is kind of done according to plan, which, they trot out the plan, the same one they used last year, modified a little bit, maybe in the edges, and do it all again. In terms of differences in terms of tone, I think they're trying to be cooperative. We may not hear that too often from the media on this end. But I did get the sense that they would like to reduce the level of tension with the United States and especially with Europe in their relations. And so the problem for them is that they've gotten a little rusty at how to talk about that. So they're trying for the cooperative tone, but every so often all those grievances that they keep, and we can probably all recite the list from memory at this point of the various Russian grievances toward the post-Cold War international system led by the United States. Those grievances come through, and in what they're saying. So, but then they kind of go back. Well, but we need to call. Yes, there are all these problems, but we want to talk about them. We want to either resolve them or maybe bracket them so that we can really focus on terrorism, which is the real threat that they want to talk about. The other thing that I'll say about the topics is. So that part about terrorism, there was a panel about the Middle East, there was a panel about instability in Central Asia, there was a panel on missile defense, very much all kind of routine at this point. The one thing that was new in terms of topics, and probably the most interesting, was when they started talking about information warfare, and that really, in a way, maybe would have been the best theme in terms of making it interesting for the conference. The problem is that you can't that it kind of contradicts the idea of trying to be more cooperative. If that was the theme of the conference, that would be very much an in-your-face kind of message to the United States, given the situation with the election and so forth. So I think they wisely chose not to make that the theme, but they did have a very interesting panel about it, and also some remarks by I think it was the defense minister, might have been the chief of the general staff, but one of the two of them spoke a fair bit about information warfare and how it's the new model of confrontation and the danger that it poses to governments and so forth. So in the panel they had a range of people from including a general, but also one of the leading television personalities and a very kind of fiery deputy from the State Duma. So plus some foreign experts as well. So that was sort of the most innovative, I guess is the right word, part of the conference.
You know, one of the great quotes from your article in National Interest is that one of the Russians apparently said it, or maybe, you know, that NATO, which they seem to be quite concerned about these days, is not a stamp collecting club. Could you kind of explain the context of that and what their concerns are about?
Yeah, that was the Russian defense minister. And so this was part of the, you know, the line that they often take on how NATO has been encroaching on Russia and surrounding it. And that in order to highlight the danger that NATO poses to Russia, he said, you know, NATO isn't a stamp collecting club. It's a military political alliance with military forces and bases and that sort of thing. So that was the context, was that, you know, the U.S. is orchestrating an expansion of NATO to Russia's borders, and, you know, has been for 20 odd years, and that's a threat to Russia.
Along those lines, I've always found pictures and visuals to really be important when you're trying to get a perspective. It's like, for those that are on the show page right now, in the little series of pictures I have up there, I have one of my favorite maps of Russia that I've seen recently that shows the view of Russia from the Arctic. We're looking out where you can really get a view of, especially for Americans, who our neighbors are Canada and Mexico. I mean, come on. That's a pretty benign environment, you know, compared to Russia and all that deep history as well. But one of the things that got my attention, because it built off of a discussion we had a few episodes with one of our guests about the reasons that China objects so much to THAAD being in South Korea, is the fact that, you know, you have to look at it from the Chinese perspective. They see that as a threat to their, you know, small and relatively small second strike capability of nuclear weapons. But there's one of the slides there, because when an American, especially an American naval type, thinks about ballistic missile defense, they think about our BMD destroyers based out of Spain, and we think about, you know, the Mediterranean and the Eastern Atlantic and all the potential problems coming from the direction to the southeast. But the Russian visual had our DDGs pretty much circling every piece of water they could have, trying to demonstrate why they see the BMD destroyers as not being a benign presence from a Russian point of view. Do the Russians see, similar to the Chinese, our efforts at ballistic missile defense a lot differently than how the Americans, how we describe why we're having it to the world? And do they really believe what we say, or do they really see it as a maligned placement, as some of their slides suggest?
Oh, they definitely see it as a direct threat to the Russian second strike capability, and they're not, you know, that's not just talk. Now, what they will tell you is that what you guys say about how you the Americans don't have the capability and aren't going to have the capability to eliminate, you know, to have enough of a missile defense shield to counter all of our, you know, 1,000+ warheads, even if that's true now, we can't depend on that in the future. Because if you develop this, then you'll expand, you know, once you have a working missile defense shield, the political pressure will be on to make it more and more effective, and over time you'll develop it such that it counters even our relatively large arsenal. So right now, you may, you know, you the Americans may honestly believe what you're saying about this is mostly aimed at North Korea and Iran. But first of all, we don't believe that because of some, you know, details about where the some of the defensive systems are being placed, and that it just doesn't make sense to spend this much money on countering two programs, one of which is, you know, isn't really progressing, and the other isn't really a threat to you, the United States, anyway. So, you know, because it's mostly aimed at, you know, if it weren't, you know, Iran is mostly aimed at, you know, maybe Israel or Europe or something, but it's not going to reach the United States. And so why are you spending all this money if it's really aimed at those two countries? But even if that's true, and you only are aimed at those two countries now, once you develop it, Congress is going to say, hey, okay, now that we have this, let's expand it and let's really protect all of America against nuclear weapons. And that's what, and down the road, that's what we got to, that's what we're concerned about, and that's what we want to try to prevent now.
How much of, I mean, is this just normal Russian paranoia that, or is this related to the current administration over there, if you can call it an administration?
In Russia? Well, I think this message has been pretty constant as long as I remember hearing more or less. You know, I mean, maybe some of the details have changed, but it's been more or less the same message since the late 90s, I think. It's just that they have more resources now to try to, and they're more concerned because the program is more advanced than it was, you know, 20 years ago. One thing that was interesting, you know, to go back for a second to the International Security Conference, is that the one thing that they've done that they did differently this time compared to in the past when, you know, at the various missile defense panels and so forth that I've been to, is that they really incorporated China into this model of thinking. And the way, the format of that panel was very much designed to broadcast that. There was a Russian general and there was a Chinese general on the, you know, on the platform talking, and all of the slides and so forth that the Russians showed incorporated, and I think this may be what you were referring to, they incorporated threats to China, you know, within that same kind of set of visual slides of, you know, where the destroyers are and, you know, what they might hit and so forth. So they really seem to have the Chinese on board publicly in a way that maybe wasn't the case before, with the same kind of messaging about the threat of missile defense. And I'm sure that has to do with the Chinese vision of THAAD as being a more immediate threat now that it's in the process of being implemented.
I've always found the ongoing partnership between Russia and China interesting, because you would think that there would be, in living memory, they've you know, they fought a couple of little border skirmishes, well, on the fringes of living memory. There's a lot of border issues to this day, especially in Russia, the Russian Far East. There's still some Chinese resentment about that acquisitions. But they do seem to always want to come back together. And going back to the, I guess we can call it the unofficial Russia's favorite holiday, Festivus, and the airing of grievances. How much of that is just Russia's desire to find other, lack of a better phrase, non-Western powers that they can work with to counter the U.S. and the West, being fed not so much by historical or potential conflict, but just an ongoing resentment and loss of status since the fall of the Soviet Union?
I think that does play a role. You know, the Russian relationship with the Chinese was always very fraught. In large part, I mean, we can go from, and the reasons have never really changed that much. I mean, the Sino-Soviet split has a lot of the same reason I'm about to go through, which is that the Russians see themselves as a European and therefore more civilized country, and they look down on the Chinese, when the Chinese, of course, look down on the Russians. And so there's a psychological tension there that prevents a real, you know, alliance, let's put it that way. There can be partnerships for instrumental reasons or because the international situation is set up in a certain way, but that level of respect, I guess, that, you know, characterizes some of the strongest alliances in history and in the present is not really there. You know, if you think of like the U.S. and Britain, that kind of alliance, that's just not going to happen with the Russians and the Chinese. And especially it was difficult when the power dynamics were have been flipping over the last 20-odd years, where Russians were used to looking down on the Chinese as weaker economically, militarily, etc. And as the Chinese have developed and have become really stronger than the Russians, this sort of the realization that if they were to have an alliance with the Chinese, they would have to have the role of a junior partner really rankled among a lot of the foreign policy elite and so forth in Russia. So, but what happened in the last, and so we saw, you know, kind of warming and cooling over the years. Putin was very smart, and back in 2004, the leadership in Russia figured out that China was on the way up, and they settled all the active border disputes with China at that point, before China got too strong and wanted, you know, and they figured that over time their bargaining, the Russians' bargaining position was only going to decline, so it's better to settle it early. Now it's true that there's still the Chinese, among, you know, certain Chinese nationalist types, there's still resentment over, you know, territory claims, let's say, over certain parts of Siberian territory, but the official line in China is very much that's all resolved. So that's something that the Russians did quite smartly back you know, 10-15 years ago. But then there was there were periods when they would sell arms to China, and then they refused to sell arms to China for various reasons. And then we see after 2014, when the relationship with the West really deteriorated, they realized that they didn't really have much of a choice other than to build more of a partnership with China. And we're seeing the results of that now, where they've been doing things with China on a much, you know, on the military side, certainly at a much deeper level than they were willing to do prior to 2014. And that's likely to continue as long as the confrontation with the West continues, because they recognize that they need somebody back in the day, Nixon realized that there was this triangle, and the best thing to do would be to take the third party and gang up on Russia with the Chinese. Well, now the Russians realize that if they don't get close to the Chinese, West and China are likely to develop closer and closer ties, in large part because of the economic relationship, and then they'll be isolated in that same way, and that would really prevent them from having much influence in the overall international system, which is really, I think, one of the main driving goals of their foreign policy, is to reestablish Russia as a key player in the overall international system.
Do they, do the Russians acknowledge, as they're looking at the world, do they acknowledge any of the reasons why the West and the Japanese, they might be a little suspicious of their motivations when they look at Georgia and Crimea and Ukraine and the Kuril Islands and a few things like that. Is there any acknowledgement that, oh yeah, well, you know, if somebody was doing the things we were doing, we might, somebody else doing the things we're doing, I might be a little nervous too. Or is that just blown off as they're protecting Russian citizens or whatever?
I think it's there isn't that recognition, and it goes even farther than what you said. It's more that the notion, and you've probably heard Putin or various other Russian leaders talk about double standards. And that's really the way they see it. They say, well, look, we know what the U.S. reaction was when the Soviet Union was messing around in Cuba. And if we were doing that kind of thing on countries on bordering the U.S. and, you know, Mexico or whatever, the reaction would be very strong. And so that's what you're doing to us by talking about how, you know, Georgia has a right to be on NATO, and we don't accept that, that we need to have a sense of security on our borders. Now, you know, we used to just control those republics that was part of our country. Now we've, you know, Soviet Union's broken up and they're independent countries, but we just like them to stay non-hostile to us, and you're not accommodating that. You're saying, hey, they should be part of this military alliance aimed at that is aimed at containing Russia and having, you know, Ukraine and Georgia in NATO is essentially, you know, a dagger aimed at you know, at Russian security.
Which is a perfect lead in to my question, which concerns what our friend Field Marshal Bismarck would call a damn fool thing in the Balkans. I found one of the more, I had to look at it to make sure it wasn't an onion, but when you look at October 16 through early spring, Montenegro, a little Balkan country of 620,000, was brought into NATO. You know, nice ports and all. They only have a military of 2,000. They spent over a decade getting in. And there was a lot of gnashing of teeth and rending of clothes and rumors of assassination attempts and coup d'etats and Russians involved. And obviously Russia wasn't too happy with seeing another part of their outside peripheral Slavic friends joining NATO in that perspective. You know, when we're looking at 100 years on from World War One, that pan-Slavic attitude that would extend all the way into the Balkans, is that just a shadow of what it used to be in the previous few centuries? Or are there real significant Russian interests remaining in the Balkans that would ever lead them to be interested in, you know, pushing back one more march forward in NATO of what used to be their little brothers in the southeast?
Look, I don't think Montenegro is, you know, strategically critical for Russia by any means, and probably never was. but anything that can weaken NATO. NATO unity, in particular, is seen as a benefit to Russia. So it's, you know, the admission of Montenegro is not as big a deal as the Baltics were, or as Ukraine or Georgia would be, but that's what's still on the table right now, and therefore, and it's a country where they have a lot of influence through various kind of economic connections, including, you know, some of questionable legality. You know, there's a, you know, various kind of gray zone economic ties with people with various Montenegro.
That's a nice way of putting it, Dimitri. Nice way.
So you know, so they have the ability to mess around, and is what I'm trying to say. And so, and it's fairly low cost. So why not try and see if that has some effect on hurting NATO unit? I mean, we've seen that, you know, it's some of the same reasons why they're playing with election, influencing elections or influencing or trying to encourage kind of anti-EU political forces in countries that are peripheral within Europe. You know, I mean, it's one thing to try to influence elections in Germany or France, but it's maybe, well, I'd say less strategically significant to do so in Bulgaria or to have the various connections that they do in Hungary. But all those countries, you know, since they're NATO members, I mean, since they're EU members, also NATO members, they can have an effect on, a negative effect on the unity of those and the strength of those European institutions, and that's a plus for Russian for foreign policy.
Somebody just put up a question on the on our chat room, which asked about Turkey, and I think I remember a headline from Al Jazeera about, can Turkey and Russia become allies? Is there a possibility of that? Is Erdogan just being a thug, or is this a part of the ISIS fight, or what?
Well, I mean, I think there are certain commonalities, and there are certain very sharp differences, and so it's a kind of a fraught relationship, and we've seen that over the last, I mean, think about the perturbations in that relationship over the last year and a half, you know, from gradual warming of ties to essentially, you know, a complete parting of the ways and even sanctions after the Russian aircraft was shot down, to reconciliation, and now they're kind of friends again, right? And so what you have is a fairly volatile leader in Turkey, and a Russian leader that isn't that certainly not, you know, I think Putin is not volatile in the same way, but he's also in a you know, the Russian leadership is in a position where things that are sort of direct public insults to Russia or demonstrations that Russia is weak in some way can't be taken lying down. So that's why the reaction to the plane being shot down, for example, is that they have to demonstrate to the domestic audience and also to the international community that they're not to be trifled with. So that when things go wrong, they could go wrong quite quickly. But in the meantime, there are certain, you know, both countries agree on the undesirability of the international community or certain Western countries preaching to them about respecting human rights and democracy and that sort of thing. And so that kind of brings them together. They have certain common interests in the Middle East, but also some very divergent interests in the Middle East. You know, on the one hand, they both want to fight ISIS. On the other hand, they have very different attitude towards Kurds. So it's still a fraught relationship, but certainly one where maybe they have more in common than, you know, I mean, the traditional Russian or in previous previously Soviet-Turkish relationship, which was one of complete distrust.
I want to circle back here to one of the things we just briefly mentioned about the Moscow Conference on International Security that you got back from, because it prompted when we were discussing Montenegro, and you said anything that can weaken, and it brought to mind different nations and militaries kind of can view the same topic in relatively radically different ways. For instance, I spent about half a day at one point in my life watching the American and German staff officers just go right at each other, talking about the information warfare and the spectrum that goes from psyops through information operations to public affairs, and where are the firewalls, what is what audience, what can you do, what can't you do, how do your different operations fold into that. And you know, how it supports a larger effort. And they did talk a lot at the conference in Moscow on information warfare. How do the Russians look at that spectrum of psyops, information ops, public affairs, and information warfare that might be slightly different than what an American might view that function in the national security arena?
Sure. Yeah, it is quite different, and it's not. I think that there's probably a level of expertise that I don't have on the details of both sides, really. You know, in terms of how, you know, I'm not an information warfare guy. So, but at the sort of the maybe slightly more superficial level, they see it as very much integrated into all aspects of their operations. So it's not a separate thing that you do over here while you conduct your regular military operations over here. It's part of, in a well-designed operation, it's part of the overall plan. And to that end, they're now starting to develop kind of information operations. I don't remember the exact level. I think companies, but you know, sort of small units, relatively small units in each division or combined arms army. I'm a little hesitant because I may be getting the specific levels wrong, but the general idea is there, that there are units now being created for conducting these kind of operations within each army unit, and that's part of that whole integration effort. So it's, and we saw that in the Crimea operation for one thing. I mean, that's kind of a very clear case where there was at the same time as they were bringing in forces to occupy Crimea, they were doing a number of other things. One, having the sort of forces without insignia to create that little bit of confusion so that maybe somebody might hesitate before blaming Russia for the whole thing, at the same time massing troops on another front and on the eastern border of Ukraine, not because at that point they weren't planning to do anything there, but as a distraction to sort of, and this is not anything different from, I mean, the Allies did that in for D-Day, right? But it's a common thing to do. But it's all kind of operations. It's all kind of integrated into the plan. Now, sometimes you don't have the opportunity to have a full plan, and we saw this to a larger extent with eastern Ukraine, where the initial plan was for various points there was an effort to try to prevent the defeat of the separatists at the lowest possible cost. And as the Ukrainians proved to be more effective than initially the Russians thought they would be at fighting back, they had to keep ratcheting up the involvement to the level where at a certain point it became quite open that Russian troops were being used, although they continued to deny it. So in those kind of operations, it may not always work to have a full information warfare plan, because you might be changing the plan too quickly to make it work. But that's the idea anyway, is to have it as part of the whole system, rather than as just something, okay, we're going to conduct information operations over here while we conduct, you know, everyone else kind of conducts warfare over here, and they're two different things.
One of the other interesting things to me is, given that Russia is trying to cozy up to China a little bit, they're also still selling or working with India on various defense deals, including the fifth generation fighter and this BrahMos, whatever the Russian name for that hypersonic missile. Is this just Russia selling stuff like we sell India, you know, all the things we can, or is this going to be a problem with them, do you think, down the road in trying to deal with China, as India and China begin to kind of, you know, more aggressively pursue control of certain areas of the world down there?
Well, I think they're trying to kind of massage all those relationships as best they can, and it's not just India, it's also Southeast Asia, which is a very promising market for them for arms sales, with Vietnam, with Indonesia. You know, they were trying, well, I'm not sure it's going to go anywhere, but there was a point after Duterte made some of his more radical anti-U.S. statements, where they were trying to say, hey, we could sell arms to the Philippines also. So there are a lot of potential customers there that are all very leery of the Chinese. You know, that's one thing they all have in common. And so there's concern about not, you know, and the Chinese, on the other hand, have this well-deserved reputation of not really being repeat customers for many items. In other words, they buy a small set of aircraft, whatever it is, as they can get away with from the Russians, and then try to make their own version of whatever, you know, the aircraft or the missiles and so forth. So the Russians don't recognize that, and they've taken some steps to try to solve some of those problems with the Chinese in terms of copying, but they recognize that they could, in terms of financial rewards for arms sales, they could get a lot more out of Southeast Asia and India with compared to China over the long run, and so they don't want to completely alienate those markets. So I think, you know, at the end, it is about trying to sell whatever they can to whoever is willing to buy. But they certainly recognize the tension there, and that's one of the things that for many years they refused to take sides in the South China Sea dispute, for example. For I think in large part for this reason, that they didn't want, if they came down too much on China's side, they know that they would create some level of fear in, say, Vietnam in particular, maybe Indonesia as well, and so they were trying to avoid that. And so when I think it was last year, maybe the year before, but sometime in the last 18 months or so, they actually did some exercises with the Chinese that implicitly recognize some of the Chinese claims in the South China Sea. Tennessee, that to me was an indication that they're feeling that they have to be, that they're more dependent on China than they used to be, and maybe more than they're comfortable with, but that they sort of feel like they don't have enough. Like I said before earlier in the conversation, they don't have as much of a freedom to maneuver now because of the relationship with the West being the way it is. And just to sort of tie it all up, I think to some of the other things that I said, is I think that's one of the reasons why they'd like to see the relationship with the West normalized, at least to some extent, is that they'd like to have the, they don't like being so dependent on one side. They'd rather have more freedom to maneuver. And so if there was some improvement in relations with the West, then they wouldn't be as dependent on the Chinese, and then they would be able to triangulate in a way better than they have been since 2014.
Well, I would think that one place that we could find common effort, and it's an opportunity for Russia and also for the West, especially the U.S., if we can find a way to make it happen. Because the Russians have joined us in becoming involved in a long-term, low-boil military operation in the Middle East. And they've been in Syria now for a few years. And there's been a lot of talk as the operations in Mosul and Iraq end, the anti-Islamic State operations, and the U.S. proxy forces have become the Kurds, plus a few other dogs and a cat, coming in from the east and from the southeast. To the west of there is Russia and Syria. As everybody circles the Islamic State and starts to invest Raqqa, how do the Russians see the arc from why they got into Syria to whether they've accomplished what they initially came for today? And do they see any use or obligation on their part to do more against the Islamic State as Raqqa area becomes invested and under siege?
So I think they see it. They see the operation in Syria, their operation in Syria, as being rather successful. Their main goal, despite whatever rhetoric they may have been spouting at various points, their main goal was to make sure that Assad stayed in power and didn't fall to the opposition, and they succeeded in that regard. Now, there's a little bit of a disconnect between what they want and what Assad wants, and that they are perfectly happy to have a negotiated solution at this point, where Assad negotiates from a position of relative strength, but doesn't sort of have carte blanche. Assad obviously would prefer to use the various forms of military assistance that he is getting from not just from Russia, but also from Iran and from Hezbollah, and with his own forces to just wipe out the opposition and not have to negotiate with them. And that's where, and so there's a disconnect there, and I think that's the context in which I would put that chemical weapons attack from a couple months ago, in that it creates an environment where negotiations become much more difficult, and therefore kind of stymies the Russia-Turkey-Iran diplomatic effort to try to force both sides to the negotiating table. In terms of where things stand on Russia versus ISIS, I think they do have a real desire to prevent ISIS from strengthening, not necessarily wiping them out completely, because what they're actually worried about, there are a lot of fighters with ISIS who come from Muslim parts of Russia, from Central Asia, and there's concern that if ISIS were wiped out as an act of fighting force in Syria and Iraq, you know, some largish percentage of the surviving fighters from ISIS would travel back to the former Soviet Union region and engage in fighting or launch terrorist attacks and so forth there. And so they want to avoid that. At the same time, they don't want to have ISIS, you know, the opposite scenario where ISIS sort of has a nice stable base with territorial control is also not good for them, because they can use that to also launch fighters into other parts of the world, including Russia, and do the same kinds of things. So in a way, it may be that a weakened ISIS that is still trying to fight may well be the best situation for Russia. Now, one thing that I thought was interesting is that while, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the U.S. Cruise missile strikes in response to the chemical attack, the Russians suspended that deconfliction agreement that they had with the United States for aircraft. What I heard at the Moscow conference was that yes, we suspended the agreement, but you know, on a working level, people are still talking. Like, nothing's really changed in principle in terms of making sure that we don't accidentally, you know, shoot each other. But you know, on a formal level, there's things are difficult, so there's suspended cooperation. So I think there is still certainly incentives for the two sides and others as well to work together. But the environment is one where there's potential for cooperation, but it's probably not enough to, you know, create any kind of full-blooded partnership. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because it seems to me that if Moscow is a little bit loosey-goosey on whether they want ISIS to exist or not, and whereas our government and some other governments have taken a pretty strong stand that we want ISIS eliminated from the face of the earth, which may or may not be possible, you know, I'm sure there's, on a Venn diagram, there's some overlap there somewhere, but are they using ISIS or all international Islamic jihadi terrorism as a hopeful ground for cooperation with the West?
I mean, yes, certainly it is something that they talk about in terms of potential for cooperation. And it's sort of, I think part of it is that it's a thing that's easy for everyone to latch on to. Everyone is opposed to terrorism, and therefore you can say, hey, we're opposed to terrorism, you also are opposed to terrorism, let's all work together. The problems come when you start trying to define what do all the different sides mean by terrorism, and which parts of which kinds of terrorists do you want to focus on fighting, and how do you want to do that, right? And so that is where the hard questions will be asked, and the hard negotiations would have to come. And I don't think anyone's really had. Maybe there are some of those conversations happening, but they're not at a practical level yet. And I don't know. Yeah, it's certainly the best hope for cooperation between Russia and the West, but I don't know how much it'll actually get us. And even if it did develop, I think it would still be, you know, a fairly small chunk of the overall relationship, and the other parts wouldn't just kind of. We're not going to become great friends overall just because we're both fighting ISIS together.
Besides the drastically different cultures, well, not drastically different, but fairly different cultures between most of the West and Russia, there's also that information gap that is getting in the way of people really trying to understand Russia as she continues to try to get her footing. And every year she seems to be getting better after the fall of the Soviet Union. But what is going on, or is a growing story or a growing influence on the Russians and the Russian character that you wish that the American public was able to either understand better or read more about? What is really important going on in Russia that when you come back to the U.S. or the Western European press, just isn't being discussed about, that you wish we could get more information on, as that would help everybody understand Russia better and perhaps decision makers be able to see opportunities when they present themselves to bring things down to a more useful level?
Yeah, I think it's something actually that we briefly touched on earlier, which is that I think there's a lack of understanding of where Russia is coming from in the confrontation, and that there is a widespread belief, certainly in the media when you read various articles, but also I think in a good chunk of the policy community, that Russia is kind of a revanchist power bent on reintegrating the territories that it lost after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and is kind of aggressively minded to change borders and expand. Whereas the Russian point of view on this is very much that they are the weaker party, they are on the defensive, they are being surrounded by the West with these, you know, NATO military bases and not NATO, then, you know, other U.S. allies such as Japan. And that there is a feeling of vulnerability in Russia that is driving a lot of their foreign policy, including the parts that we see as aggressive. And I think if there was an understanding of that mentality on the Russian side, and I've written about this in some pieces that you can find on my blog and elsewhere, but that I think if there was a better understanding of where the Russians were coming from, we would have a better ability to sort of, you know, it's always easier to negotiate if you can put yourself in the other side's shoes and model their thinking correctly. Then it's not necessarily, you know, we're not going to agree that, you know, that we're on the same, now that we understand where you the Russians are coming from, we'll definitely hand over Georgia and whatever else. That's not what I mean. But I think that this misapprehension that Russia is aggressively minded drives a misunderstanding of potential future actions and a misunderstanding of how Russia might react to various things that is problematic. For Russia and for the Soviet Union before it, there's always this kind of desire to have a buffer zone. We saw this when there was the Soviet Union, and we had Eastern Europe as the buffer zone. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, and they gave away Eastern Europe from their point of view, and so. But then the Ukraine and Belarus could be the buffer zone, and that was, they were kind of reconciled with that. But now it seems to them like, hey, the West is trying to break through that and take over the buffer zone, and maybe as part of a an attempt to weaken Russia and maybe, you know, even, you know, some of the more concerning aspects to them is, you know, maybe even conduct regime change within Russia itself.
Wow. Dimitri, you spent a great hour with us. And, as usual, I've got more questions to ask that would probably take another 2 or 3 hours or weeks. Not having that kind of time, let me see, just ask you what you're going to be working on. We can look forward to, I think we've referenced your blog a number of times. But where should people be looking for future stuff from you about these exciting and very interesting and disturbing topics?
Well, the stuff I'm working on is kind of the directions have been largely the same for the last year or two. Continuing to look at what the Russian Navy is doing, what their approaches to warfare are, looking at some of their A2AD types of activities and that. So that's sort of one direction, and the other direction is we at CNA, I'm particularly more and more interested in some of the things we talked about I talked about in the last question. How does the Russian worldview and how it affects Russian decision making, and how that translates into their operations and their foreign policy and so forth. So I think certainly in those two areas are where I'll be. Writing in the near future, and maybe some things on defense industry and modernization and arms sales. I'm always kind of interested in that, so I have some ideas about writing on that in the next year as well.
Well, if you're writing on it, then I'm going to be reading it. That sounds like some great, especially the naval stuff. That's fascinating, especially when they did that great live fire demonstration from the Caspian that got everybody's attention. So it was a pretty good marketing exercise
on
their part.
That was the intent.
If nothing else. Yeah.
They certainly didn't need to hit Syrian targets with Kalibr missiles for any reason other than marketing, because they were doing quite fine with uncontested air superiority.
Yeah, good information warfare and operations and PAO work on their part. But
yes.
Thoroughly enjoyed the hour, Dimitri. Thank you very much, and we'll be looking forward to the opportunity to talk to you again in the future.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Yes, really enjoy it. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition to Midrats. And just a quick note for those that are either with us live or especially those joining us on the podcast, if you get a second, if you like the show, head on over to iTunes or Stitcher. Give us a 5-star review, just so when people are searching for maritime and national security shows, they can get us to pop up and maybe give a listen to us. And I hope that everybody has a great Memorial Day weekend coming up. We'll have a best of over the Memorial Day weekend, but make sure and join us on the 4th when we're going to have as our guest Pat Cronin from the Center for the New American Security to discuss their views on the direction the Chinese Navy is going to be growing until 2030. So we look forward to seeing you all then. And until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand. And-